Good evening, and welcome to part 6 of the Jazz History of St. Louis on Jazz Unlimited. I'm Dennis Owsley. Tonight we're going to be hearing music from the period 1968 to 1974 with the Black Artists Group and the Human Arts Association. We had a number of internationally famous jazz musicians from St. Louis come out of that period. They include Lester Bowie, Oliver Lake, Julius Hemphill, Hamiet Bluett, Luther Thomas, Bikita Carroll, and Charles Bobo Shaw, among others. So sit back, but hold on to your seats for tonight's show following NPR News. Good evening. Before beginning tonight's show, we have to thank Lester Bowie, J.D. Paran, Floyd LaFleur, Julius Hemphill, Hamiet Bluett, Marty Ehrlich, Jim Wallace, Kevin Powell, and Anthony Davis. The original Jazz History of St. Louis documentary was funded by a grant from the Missouri Arts Council and was copyright 1987 KWMU. I'm Dennis Owsley. Welcome to the first hour of the Jazz History of St. Louis, Part 6 on Jazz Unlimited. We're going to be doing a bit of talking to kind of set the stage because most people in St. Louis aren't even aware what happened in progressive music here in St. Louis during the period 1968 to about 1973 or 4. And this period was one of protest over the war in Vietnam. And it was also a time when there was a split between those who were forward-looking and those who were trying to hold on to what they perceived as traditional values. While there was relative prosperity in 1967, by 1972, the nation was gripped by a recession. And these forces, which are both external and internal to St. Louis, forced a split between the traditionalists and the experimentalists in the arts, especially when the funds began to dry up by 1972. And the jazz community in St. Louis was no different. Two strong, very opposing winds blew through it. One group trying to hold dearly to what they perceived as the jazz tradition, and the other group trying to extend the tradition of jazz into ways that eventually changed the way music was thought about in the country for the next 20 years. The mainstream players were in the middle, working very quietly and not making waves. And this split between the traditionalists and experimentalists is shown in the number of recordings made during this time. 18 were Dixieland, 5 were mainstream, and 12 belonged in the avant-garde category. When the music scenes at Gaslight Square, the Blue Note, and the DeBolivar Strip collapsed in 1967, jazz musicians faced a bleak future with few places to play. The Dixieland players found a haven on the riverfront with the purchase and reopening of the Goldenrod Showboat by Frank Pearson in 1964. The Old Levee House and other entertainment venues featured jazz as a way to connect nostalgically to romantic notions about the riverboat era in St. Louis's history. The St. Louis Ragtimers played as the house band on the Goldenrod Showboat for 20 years. And the National Ragtime and Traditional Jazz Festival was held on the Goldenrod every Labor Day weekend from 1965 until 1990 when it moved to St. Charles. Nearly all of the Dixieland recordings made during this period are out of print and are unavailable. Some black musicians who were not traditional jazz musicians decided to develop their own style and eventually an organization to present their music. This movement was part of what was nationally known as the Black Arts Movement. The St. Louis organization became the Black Artists Group. BAG musicians, along with those from the Association for the Advancement of Creative Musicians, the AACM, in Chicago, changed the music in New York when they moved there. Here's Lester Bowie discussing his early career and what happened when the scene collapsed in 1967.
I got a question. quite a bit of exposure playing in public. I started playing professionally when I was a young teenager in St. Louis. So my main influence as far as jazz was a fellow named Bobby Danzig, who was a quite well-known trumpet player in St. Louis at that time and quite good trumpet player at that time. He never developed an international reputation, but as far as his playing ability, when he was up there with the best of them, his name was Bobby Danzig. And when I was about 14, 15 years old, I used to go over to his house, and he used to just show me little things and tell me little things that I still remember to this day. I think over the years, these St. Louis trumpet players did develop a specific approach to the instrument, a more personal approach. Trumpet players from St. Louis really sounded distinctive when you compared them with trumpet players from other places. And I think it was because we tried to develop an approach that was more personal. But Bobby used to always tell me that, he said, Lester, whatever you do, whatever you end up playing, always be soulful. So it was about having a soulful, singing, personal sort of sound. That was our goal. Well, at the time, what happened was that it got so bad in St. Louis, it got to where there was no scene at all. You know, when I first started to go out in St. Louis, there was a scene. There were musicians, there were places you could go to sit in and play. And there were four or five clubs in St. Louis that had music, that had jazz music. The Riviera was a theater that was open at that time, and they had shows would come through, large-type shows. And there was some sort of musical scene, but over the years, this scene was completely eliminated. By the time Bad came along, there was no scene at all. If you were a young musician, there was nowhere to go to learn your craft, nowhere to go to have dialogue with other musicians. It was non-existent. So that was the reason we had to create our own situation. We did it first in Chicago, and then the musicians in St. Louis did it. We had to develop our own situation. It was necessary for our survival because there was no support at all. Now, when we were playing, I mean, you had to play wherever you can. You know, we used to go out right behind the Art Museum there and play all the time. Oliver and Julius and myself, we would go out there every day and just play. Because, you know, to play music, you have to play. You have to have dialogue with other musicians. And you have to have some place to exchange ideas and to develop your own ideas. And you have to find them wherever you can. And when it was warm, we would go right up behind the Art Museum and play all day. It was a great time. But there was no other scene. You have to understand that there is no scene for a jazz musician. I mean, not only in St. Louis, but a lot of cities.
I'm Dennis Owsley, and this is The Jazz History of St. Louis, Part 6. We heard Lester Bowie talking about what happened to him as he grew up and where they went and played. Bagg worked cooperatively with the AACM in Chicago, and it was a major influence on the formation of Bagg, as well as another group called the Human Arts Association in St. Louis. They performed regularly at their own facilities, university concert halls, and elsewhere, before touring France and relocating to New York and other cities. Most of the Bagg members were native St. Louisans. During the 1950s, there was an amazing number of talented musical artists at Sumner, Soldan, and Vashon high schools. They included trumpeters Lester Bowie and Floyd LaFleur, pianist trumpeter David Hines, woodwind player J.D. Perrin, drummers Chuck Carter, Philip Wilson, Jerome Scrooge Harris, and Kenny Rice, and future opera star Grace Bumbry. Saxophonist Oliver Lake had been playing bass drum and cymbals in a drum and bugle corps since the age of 14 and started playing saxophone at 17 to be on the school band. Julius Hemphill was from Texas, and his wife was from St. Louis, and they moved into the city in 1966, and Julius worked at various non-musical jobs until he became a substitute music teacher in the St. Louis City Schools. He played in rhythm and blues bands with Oliver Lake and so forth. Outside of the rhythm and blues gigs, there was no place for these forward-looking musicians to play and learn their craft. The musicians started playing, as Lester Bowie described, in Forest Park in the summertime outside. And here's Hamiet Bluett describing the dedication of these musicians.
That's basically what we wanted to do. We had sort of gotten tired of just playing one way. And it was in the vogue to go all in different directions anyway. And I wanted to play every day. We made a commitment. And I found that if you want to play every day, guys said, well, let's get a piano, bass, and a drum, a guitar, this, that, and the other. Well, them cats will always play every day. Because they can get a job and work. If you just play an instrument, if you don't have a piano, bass, and drums, you can't play. So we said, later. You know, so whoever showed up, we'll just play. So with two horns played, four horns. The guy might say, well, I'm a poet. And we said, okay, we'll figure out what to do with the poet. So we just started involving anybody. We didn't call it multimedia. You know, I found it out later that that was a classification. I mean, you never thought about it, you know. You know, and then come to find that has been, a name has been out there for maybe decades. I just never even dealt with it. Because like I said, our whole thing was just to participate every day. Because that's the only way you're going to do it anyway. It has to be. It can't be weekend and maybe weekend for work, but it's got to be every day. Now, that's the only way you're going to do it. Like anything else, if you're going to be an Olympic swimmer, you don't wait and swim on Saturday and Sunday. You swim every day. And forever, right? Until you can't swim no more, then you keep on teaching other people every day. So it's an everyday affair. So that's the way we start trying to do it. And by doing it that way, we came up with some bizarre combinations. And I mean, you know, like things I never thought about. So that's how I found out, well, wow, if you don't play with a drummer, this happens. If you don't play with a piano, that happens, you know. So we did it and did it and did it and kind of worked it up to where we could actually play and we liked it. Now, the people didn't care for it that much because it was different. I went to New York, everybody was going crazy.
I'm Dennis Owsley, and we heard Hamiet Bluett talking about how you have to work and how hard you have to work to be a dedicated professional musician. When they visited the AACM, the St. Louis musicians got the idea to organize. Much of the organization centered around Lacledetown, which was beginning to be a hotbed of left-wing political and bohemian culture. The Berean Presbyterian Church was a focal point for these political activities. The congregation was racially mixed and even had a theater group. The spark that united the musical, artistic, and political impulses of it was an idea of the poet, actor, and stage director Malinke Elliott to not only stage Jean Genet's play, The Blacks, but also to integrate dance and music into the performance at the Loretto Hilton at Webster University in 1967. Oliver Lake and his art quartet, along with Julius Hemphill and two other musicians, provided a series of chamber pieces composed by Lake to accompany the dancers. J.D. Perrin and Floyd LaFleur described the kickoff of Bag, which was incorporated in 1968.
I remember a big music program, which Hemphill did a lot of writing for, and maybe some others at the Art Museum. And there was a big play, Genet's The Blacks, at the Loretta Hilton.
So after Hemphill got out of service, it was myself, and this was like the very inception of BAG, Black Artist Group. We got together, and we decided we should form an organization similar to the AACM, where we could do creative things that was not that receptive in the clubs and things like that. So right at its inception, it was myself, Oliver Lake, Julius Hemphill, a writer by the name of Bob Elliott, who was an actor. And we said, well, you know, let's include the dance, the visual arts, and things like that. And also, it was very easy to get grants at that time. We got a nice grant from the Rockefeller Danforth Foundation. So that helped us immensely. We got a building and a place to perform, and we used to do all kinds of stuff there. We included all the arts, whereas the AACM, for the most part, it was about music. The very first performance we did was at the Art Museum, and it was like it was a multimedia art type thing. With dance, music, poetry, acting. And the audience was very receptive at that time. And like I said, it was a period when we just did a lot of experimental things. Sometimes they worked, sometimes they didn't work. It was one thing about it, you know, most people, when they left a concert, they either hated it or loved it. They had a reaction, you know, that was the whole point of it. Uh-huh.
One of the things I wanted to mention about Bag that is very significant and was really a part of the times was that in all these organizations, you know, even in then you could see that the musicians got a lot of the attention. But what was really happening was that the poetic people, and in Bag, one of the main developed voices of that time was Jule Rutland, Sonny Rutland. The poets, playwrights, and actors and dancers. So we used to get out there and give these pageant-type performances a lot. You know what I mean? A lot of ritualistic stuff influenced by, you know, the whole African identity that was coming out at that time.
I'm Dennis Owsley, and this is Jazz Unlimited's Jazz History of St. Louis, Part 6. The Oliver Lake Art Quartet also was featured in an award-winning short film called Jazz Zoo. Pictures of the St. Louis Zoo and music that they composed for it. That film does exist. There's a copy of it at the Sheldon Art Gallery. The concert, which is called The Third World, took place at the Art Museum in Forest Park in August of 1967, was advertised in a one-inch notice in the Post-Dispatch and Globe Democrat newspapers. It drew an overflow audience that kept changing as some walked out and others took their places, and the group got a standing ovation from those who remained. But no review of the concert exists, and notice the only ad for this concert. No preview in the papers. In September 1969, Hamiet Bluett went to New York and began making an impression on that scene. A year later, he convinced James Jabbo Ware to make the move as well, and we will hear the music of Jabbo Ware in succeeding installments. Bluett returned to St. Louis periodically and took part in the Julius Hemphill Dogon AD sessions. Lester Bowie periodically returned to St. Louis as well and brought the Art Ensemble of Chicago for extended stays. Bag, the AACM, and the Detroit Musicians Collective also exchanged groups so that there was some cross-fertilization between the organizations. Once Bag was incorporated, they got grants and a building on Washington Avenue. And here's a piece from a concert at the Bag House in 1970 by a group called the Children of the Sun. It's after Jeremiah Swed. Then we will hear Lester Bowie talking about interchanges with the AACM.
Cities suddenly went wild. Their madness rising to a new on eerie cold beams of song. In the dark, crisp autumn night, you and I chose for walking through swift blue rhythms with gilt edges and your heaven above us gleaming through its hole. Thank you. rabbit fangs felled many a tree, and baby would have felled us had we not risen to the low boughs of a gentle fall tree, where I hungrily sucked your pussy. And love, you smiled and did not think me craven. But when morn was born, the paper beside your morning coffee, forgive me, said a small black paper boy, was found mangled and torn, caught, overturned newspapers, strewn and uneasy pages, flapping, 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 quick golden rhythms on Madison Street, back through the twisted shaft, dark corridors of my youth, and over there, Jeremiah breathed.
Dennis Owsley, and this is Jazz Unlimited's Jazz History of St. Louis, Part 6. We heard After Jeremiah Swed, recorded in 1970 at the Bag House on Washington. And the Children of the Sun included Isaac Rajab on trumpet, Floyd LaFleur on trumpet and small instruments, Oliver Lake Reeds, Arzinia Richardson bass, Bobo Shaw percussion, Rashu Aten percussion, Vincent Terrell cello, and Adjelay. He was known also as Bruce Rutland. He was the poet. And here is an Oliver Lake recording called NTU, N2, Point at Which Creation Begins. The tune is Tsilane.
Thank you.
I'm Dennis Owsley, and before the station break, we heard Tsilane by the Oliver Lake Group in 1970, and the group consisted of Bakita Carroll and Floyd LaFleur on trumpet, Joseph Bowie on trombone, Oliver Lake on flute, soprano, alto, and percussion, two pianists, John Hicks and Clovis Bordeaux, Richard Martin on guitar, Don Officer Bass, Famadou Don Moyer of the Art Ensemble of Chicago on conga, and Bobo Shaw on drums. This, interestingly enough, is beginning to sound a little bit like Miles Davis's Bitches Brew ensembles. Bag musicians often performed with other allied artists. What they didn't do was play in clubs. Their forums were concerts at the Bag House, university concert halls, and other concert stages such as the Gateway Theater. And in 1969, Bag presented 30 consecutive weeks of concerts with all of these groups. And again, I want to remind you that none of these concerts were ever reviewed in any newspaper in St. Louis. And in 1971, Julius Hemphill and poet Malinke Elliott recorded an LP called The Collected Poems of Blind Lemon Jefferson on Hemphill's Mbare label. And here is Lemon's Holy Blues, recorded in 1971 with Julius Hemphill on flute and Malinke Elliott doing the poetry.
Said baby times is so hard, I almost call it tough. Won't some good man tell me some woman's name? Please tell me some woman's name. Bit of Lemon's Holy Blue. Three trees are standing on the ledge of my heart. Three trees are standing on the purple hedge of my heart. Three levels of unleavened bread. Three pinches of crude sea salt. Three unilateral pieces, they're pieces of flame and lard. All the wretched bones in my body broken, all my veins burst, and three welcome trees are moving in discharge across the ledge. They running across the ledge. Holy, 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 holy. Across the purple hedge of my heart.
I'm Dennis Owsley, and this is Jazz Unlimited's Jazz History of St. Louis, Part 6. And we heard Lemon's Holy Blues, Julius Hemphill on flute, and Malinke Elliott doing the poetry reading, recorded in 1971. Bag produced a classic recording called Dogon A.D. by the Julius Hemphill Quartet. The piece had a very complex rhythm that drummer Philip Wilson never varies from during the piece. You can hear Philip is just hanging on with his fingernails trying to keep this going. Malinke Elliott told me several years ago that the rhythm came from an Appalachian folk fiddler's recording. And here is Julius Hemphill describing the inspiration for the piece. and then we will hear Dogon AD to finish the first hour of Jazz Unlimited.
I was interested in African culture, various African cultures, and one of them was the Dogon, a tribe that lives in Upper Volta and Mali, parts of Mali. I read an article in a very beautiful color magazine put out by some published by UCLA, I think, just called African Art. And I read an article in that that said that the Dogon, who are fairly mysterious people and that they're fairly isolated, had decided to tap the tourist trade and by revealing some of their sacred dance rituals for tourists. I guess they, you know, elected to say, okay, we'll do number 31, but we want to do 35, you know, so, I don't know, I'm just guessing. But from that, I just got this notion of being a kind of a dance rhythm, you know. And actually, the full title of that is Dogon Adaptive Dance.